Hey, Barcelona, October 28th, 2006. We're away.
Yeah. So welcome, very, very much welcome to this last session. I have the honor of chairing it. My name is Carl Holberg, running from the wonderful country of North, Sweden, where I work for something called the Swedish Agency for Flexible Learning. That is one of those intermediary organizations relying on what you are doing and trying to promote the practice from the knowledge you are producing. I also have a long history in the world of universities. For many, many years I worked with a couple of them in Sweden. So I'm pleased that you could be more attracted of this than the one that put out there. And I see that more and more of you are arriving, so welcome. We will have the pleasure of meeting one of the researchers from Canada. We have several of you here, which is great. And now you will meet Stephen Downs, who's representing that group. And Stephen has had several different positions in different organizations and universities over Canada. And now he is working for the National Research Council as a senior researcher, and he's based in a place I've never been to. It's called Moncton in New Brunswick, and there he works for the Institute for Information Technologies e-learning research group. And I assume that most of you in one way or another has met Stephen on the net, where he worked with weblogs and content syndication, things like that. So I think you have some kind of knowledge about him via that practice. And here he is. And he talked to us about understanding learning networks. So you are extremely welcome. And take the floor.
Thank you. Well, welcome everybody. Or I should say, buenos dias. Or hola. I've been learning a lot of Spanish. I'm up to about 5 or 6 words now. So I'm not used to this climate, so I'm already dripping in sweat because my computer froze, and well, it's going to be one of those days, I can just tell. But I never actually did do that. I just took a picture of you, and here we go. And I hope there's nothing bad on there. I'm sure there isn't. view thumbnails. Whoops, that's not thumbnails. That'll do. And so, generating preview. This is Windows, right? Generating preview. We're waiting. What could be hard about that? Okay. Yeah, you're right. It's taking it from the camera, that's why. So why don't I just never mind. Ooh, slideshow help. I never knew that existed. This is an unusual talk, as I'm sure there you are. I'm just gonna actually I won't even do that. Now what I'm gonna do here is I'm going to open up this little doodad here. It's on the Flickr uploader, and we'll just drag that into here. And there it is, and now upload, and we'll tag it Barcelona, just because, and I won't add it to a set. And now, assuming the wireless is still working, we will be uploading. So we'll let that do its thing for a little bit there. I just wanted to get that out of the way, because it takes a little bit of time. Wait. It takes a little bit of time for that to work. My topic is understanding learning networks, and I want to thank Martin for giving most of my talk earlier today. I really appreciate that. What this does is relieve me of the need to be organized or to present stuff in a linear fashion, so I am going to pick and choose a little bit. I do have some topics that I want to address, and in particular, I want to address indirectly, not directly, some of the stuff that has been said earlier at this conference, and in particular by Rob Coper, because I had the unusual experience, actually, for me, of being accused of not being Dutch or German, and I wasn't sure what to make of that. I wanted to play the "We're German" song that was on the music channels, but I couldn't find it in time. But because Rob talked about learning networks, and I talked about learning networks, and I need to emphasize that when I talk about learning networks, I think that I'm talking about something very different from what Rob is talking about when he's talking about learning networks. And so I'm talking about more like what Martin is talking about. So begin with Web 2.0, which is where a lot of this stuff starts. And you're all familiar, I'm pretty sure, with Web 2.0. And Web 2.0 is mostly about, they'll tell you, you know, it's the web is platform, not media and all of that. But mostly what Web 2.0 is about is content creation and content posting. The capacity of people to create and post their own content on the internet. And if you look at all this stuff, which has more or less become characteristic of Web 2.0, we have blogs, we have even e-portfolios these days in learning. For images, we have Flickr, and that's speaking of which, let's see how that Flickr uploader, oh, it's done. And so here's Flickr, and this is one of these, it's sort of Web 2.0-ish, and it's going to take a few moments to load. And what we're looking at now is the uploaded picture in Flickr. So now this photo has been uploaded onto my account in Flickr, and it has begun its journey. But not just photographs. Those of you who were at one of the sessions yesterday I think it was, learned about podcasting and profcasting. So there are services for audio. I am in fact producing a learning resource right now. This is my trusty iRiver. And my iRiver is currently recording this session. It's recording it in MP3 format, and it better be anyways. I know it doesn't look like it's doing much, but it's because it's not plugged in. And consequently, after this talk is done, assuming I make it through this talk without melting and dribbling into a little pool, if I do just melt and just put me in a bucket and set me outside, I'll be okay. Actually, put me on a plane, send me back to Canada, where I'll freeze. So there's a lot of audio content being produced and put onto the web. Odeo is a service that allows you to upload audio content. They don't do this anymore, but they used to do it where you could just use your mobile phone, call in your audio content, and you didn't even have to be on the web. You just phone it in, and then they would post it on the web for you. There's also Audacity, which is a wonderful free program that allows you to create and edit and mess around with MP3 and other audio files. And it's a very popular program for people who are working in audio. Video, we've all seen recently the rise of YouTube. It is now the most popular website on the web, just recently overtaken MySpace, which is another one of these content creation sites. So the whole idea here is the web 2.0 is about content creation. We see wikis, content creation in a collaborative way. I assume everybody has heard of Wikipedia. Is there any of you who has not heard of Wikipedia? Okay, well, nobody admits to that. you might wonder how wikis and the web interrelate. Well, here's a site that somebody has put up, and they've taken the South African curriculum and put it on a wiki. And so you can, you know, consumer studies, and you just click through, and there's your consumer studies curriculum, definition, purpose, and all of that. And if you don't like it, you can change it. The knowledge and skills gained in the general education and training and basket weaving. No, I won't do that. But the idea is that even things like curricula can be created in this dynamic, collaborative way. Bookmarking, we have Delicious and Furl, which are systems that allow people to collaboratively bookmark. I bookmark something, you bookmark something, and if we tag it the same, then they begin to cluster, and I can look at your tags, and you can look at my tags, and other people can look at all the bookmarks created by anybody tagged in a certain way. Online applications. Whoops. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Here's one called Writely. I quite like Writely. That almost rhymes. I'm not sure. Okay, sometimes they don't pop up, and if for some reason the browser doesn't find the website, then PowerPoint doesn't know what to do. So PowerPoint sits there and thinks. And I can't do anything on the computer until it's done what it is going to do. In a few minutes, it's going to pop up and it'll say, I can't find it. We all know that it can't find it. You notice how I'm stalling? Because it resolutely refuses to do anything until its 1 full minute is up. This is what happens when you design software ahead of time. and you think you've covered all of the bases, and you design according to a plan. And the plan is, if you are trying to access a site, give it 1 full minute. Because in all cases, you will want 1 full minute. Actually, it looks like it's even going longer. Boy, this is annoying. Yeah, we're... Could be worse. You know. Yeah, I'm going to have to kill it. This is not the first time I've had to do this. PowerPoint in the process. Terminating will cause undesirable results. Well, yes, I know that. But it's because of the undesirable result that I have to terminate it. I assume all of you talk to your computers too, so. And where did it go? There we go. But I still want Writely. And this is the silly thing. It's not like Writely didn't work, it's that it just didn't work through PowerPoint. Well, isn't that odd? Oh, right, Google bought it. I keep forgetting. They've changed it around on me. Anyhow, this was Writely, and now it's Google Documents. And so this is a document that anybody can edit. And you can actually edit this all at the same time. So now it's just docs.google.com. Here's another one that won't show up in PowerPoint. Now, one of the things I really don't like about these is that you have to log into them, but this is Gliffy. Gliffy is a really neat little collaborative content creation application. And we have to type again. It's changed. This, however, anyhow, as you can see, this isn't what I expected to see here, but nonetheless, as you can see here in this sample, which isn't the thing I thought I was opening, really, or no, open, there we go, this is the one. This is the one that I made, not that other thing that really looks bad, because that's something, there we go. And as you can see, you can create nifty documents in Gliffy, and then you can open it up and you can share it here. I don't know why I'm having such a problem with this computer. Here we go. Share, collaborate, publish info, edit it, and save it, export it as a JPEG, etc. Wonderful little tool. And again, this is your typical Web 2.0 tool. It gives really, I'd say, advanced content creation capacities to people who have limited skills. Like me, I can't draw. I can't draw at all, trust me. I've tried. But I can do real nice, almost professional looking flowchart diagrams in an application like Gliffy. Web 2.0 is also about content syndication. And what really made Web 2.0 what it is something called RSS. And I imagine by now most of you have heard of RSS. RSS is really the simplest of the metadata that there is. There are basically three elements in RSS. There's the title of a resource, there's the location of a resource, and then optionally there's a description of that resource. Now, I want you to compare that to, see, I clicked on the thing and then Windows says, would you like to open this file? And I sort of go, no, I just clicked on it for fun. And what I want to compare RSS to, and it's a bit of an unfair comparison, it always opens up at 136%, which is silly. There we go, that's much better. Here we go. Compare RSS, which has three data elements, to this. And you, this is the diagram that you saw a couple of days ago in Rob Coker's talk. And I cannot emphasize the difference between the way the RSS content network develops and this sort of model. Because with RSS, it started off, again, as I say, with very simple data elements. And they were just thrown out there into the world. And there wasn't any sort of formal definition of them. In fact, people can't even agree on what the name of the format is. Some people call it Rich Site Summary. Some people call it RDS Site Summary. Some people call it Really Simple Syndication. Some people call it ADAM. And if you want to add something to RSS, you just do it. Some people thought that putting Dublin Core into RSS would be a good idea. So what did they do? They just added Dublin Core to it. And programs that didn't have any use for it just ignored it. And programs that did have a use for it looked for it, and if it was there, great, and if it wasn't there, oh well, it's not there. Or they put syndication information, how frequently a site is updated, for example. Or some things that have happened more recently, geotagging. What a geotag is, and you put this on an image file or a document or whatever, and what that is a set of coordinates that connects your RSS post or your image or whatever to a set of coordinates on a Google map. So you click on the geotag and up pops a location in the Google map, which I think is pretty nifty. And you see, with RSS, you can do that. With this sort of approach, and I remember Rob saying, you know, all of these things have to be defined ahead of time. We all have to be speaking exactly the same terminology. Remember that? Well, what happens when something like geotags comes along? I'll bet you, dollars to donuts, there's no geotags in there. I'll bet you, Rob cannot make his resources connect to Google Maps. He's going to have to go back and revise this thing and keep revising and keep revising. So there's a big difference between planning it ahead of time and letting it develop on its own accord. Martin sort of touched on it when he talked about the different analogies. There's the analogy between an architecture, and that's your typical software programming design, user case models. I'm looking for a certain term, but I can't remember it. Use cases, all of that sort of stuff, and that's the architecture kind of model. And for buildings, you really want to do that, because if you don't plan a building ahead, it will fall down. We know this. But we're not designing software applications in Web 2.0. You might think we are, but we're not. We are designing a network. And the network is composed of a whole bunch of different things that connect together. And the better metaphor, the metaphor that I prefer to think of in that kind of environment, is of an ecology or a garden. And you know, you set out your garden, you can do some work and put things into place, but eventually you have to let go, and the garden does the work itself. The garden does the growing itself. And you know, when you're building a building, when you're creating an architecture, everything has to fit together properly. You know, imagine if that ceiling didn't fit into those walls. Bad news in a building. Especially for us, because we're under the ceiling. In a garden, not so much so. You know, your rose plant, your corn plant, they're not really designed to fit together. But, you know, you put them right beside each other, and it might work and it might not. It's a much looser kind of an organization, and very deliberately so. David Weinberger said, small pieces loosely joined. And that's your typical model of a network rather than an architecture. And the reason why I think that this distinction is important is because I think that this distinction applies not simply to learning technology, not simply to the way we build our applications, but also to our pedagogy, also to the manner in which we think about learning itself and how learning ought to be conducted. A lot of this talk is about that. So, let's see how my image is going. Here it is in Flickr. And as you can see, now right now this image is available to the whole world. Anybody in the world can see this if they have internet access. So I hope you put on your best clothes. I didn't. And I can't tell. It doesn't look like we've had any views. No, viewed zero times. Yeah. Such is my life on the web. Okay, well, we'll come back to that. So anyhow, here's how RSS works. And this is a pretty standard process, and it's not something that originated with the web, and it's not something that's restricted to the web, but basically the idea is you have a content creator, a content provider, who creates content, and then the RSS files describe that content. And then you have another type of program called a content aggregator that gathers that content together and gathers it from many different sources. And the content aggregator then takes that gathered data and presents it to a person who's doing a search for some information. They look at this, it's called an RSS feed, and they look at the aggregated data and they say, oh, I want to read such and such. And so they click on a link, and then the original item is retrieved from where it was stored originally and displayed to the user. This is a very different model than the traditional model of content organization. The traditional model of content organization is you have an original, and then you make a whole bunch of copies of that original. That's called printing. And then you take all of those copies, and you send one of those copies to each institution, and you put them in a library, and then if you want to actually access the copy, you go to the library, and there's a copy of the thing there. And it's interesting because a lot of the approaches to learning resources and learning resource repositories is on that printing and distribution model. This model is different in that the resource doesn't actually move. It doesn't go anywhere until somebody actually asks for it. Now, Rob's built technology. I built technology, except he has programmers and that, so his technology works. Mine, less so. But I do have some things. There we go. Oh, that's not it. Which one is it going to be? I really should title my pages better. Okay. Ah, here we go. This is EduRSS. Now what EduRSS does, it's an aggregator, it gathers together RSS files from about 300 or so people who write in the field of educational technology. And so we can see, I'm not good at reading, EduRSS most recent. So this is what's happening in the field of instructional technology right now. Well, once it comes up, my website has been slow recently. And I think it's probably because I'm putting too much stuff on it. I'm just having one of those days with technology. So we'll wait for that. There we go. So 10 ways to organize your life, right? Drop patent, edgy cause, urges, blackboard, and I would add my voice to that. And anyhow, this is the stuff that's just come up now. One of the things you can do when you have syndicated data is you can show the relationship between entities. And so one of the things that I've done with EduRSS is created something called conversation. And so what happens in this particular feature is for each link, for each post that's created by any of these people who are creating posts in educational technology, I scan them for the links that they contain and then try to see how one post connects to another, if one post cites another. I thought that one would actually show a conversation there, but it doesn't. But we can see an example right here of a bunch of posts, and now we're going to wait for it again. Oh, this is much faster. So here's the original post, and then this person replied to the original post, and this person also replied to the original post, and then this person replied to one of the replies. And the thing is here, you can see in this particular application how the different posts join together, how they connect together. Now, the idea of content syndication and the reason why it's different from the typical approach to online learning is that it presents a model of learning where instead of you going to the learning, instead of you doing a specific learning practice, the learning comes to you. Again, we'll think back to Rob Coker's talk, or he's talking about roles and creating a learning plan, and then the learning plan would determine the arrangements and the discovery of the resources that are presented in front of you. And it's true that some people do plan their learning, particularly people who are learning in institutions like colleges and universities. But most of the learning that we do, it could be argued, and I would argue, is unplanned. It happens in the course of us trying to do something else. I've learned, for example, a great deal about Barcelona and Castelldefels, including how to pronounce Castelldefels, and many other things. I hope I pronounced that right. I might have learned it badly. But I wasn't, I didn't plan any of that learning. What I was trying to do is, go from the airport to the hotel, find coffee, things like that, which are all non-learning tasks. So the idea here is, if you have content syndication, if you have a way of getting content from where it is into a very precisely defined location, then you can make learning available where it's needed. So what I really needed was content syndication while I was out exploring Barcelona. I needed something like, say, a map, for example, and it would have been nice to have, just learning resources, about Barcelona. Here's a nifty church. Here's a nifty cafe. Here's a place you shouldn't go, whatever. And the idea here is that the learning would be part of the environment. Now, what's happened in the world of aggregators is that they've become, the feeds that they produce have come to be presented inside online environments. And we saw one of those earlier today. This one's going to load fine. The NetVibes. And as you can see, each one of these boxes corresponds to something like an RSS feed. So here's my RSS feed, for example. Here's Boing Boings. Here's Gmail account not configured because you'd have to log in and all of that. So, and as you can see from the slide, I'll bring back the slide again, there's quite a number of these web tops being created. Windows Live is one of those sorts of web tops. Protopage, GUI, they also have cute names too. So what's happening here is with this sort of approach, instead of the static one thing, then another thing, model of learning, we have a model of learning which is much more chaotic, a lot like this talk, much more random, where you have different things at different places that are interconnected together. This is the famous Scott Wilson diagram. This diagram outlines the architecture of what one of these systems would look like. In the center, where Scott has put the word future VLE, we now call this personal learning environment. And it was sort of funny, I think it was Martin saying that, that's just what the LMS is becoming. But I wouldn't say that, but we'll come back to that. But the idea here is that my personal learning environment, which is a type of web top that I've just described, connects to all of those external resources, connects to photographs on Flickr, for example, connects to a blogging system on LiveJournal, connects to a list, a to-do list, for example, on 43 things. So there's the personal learning environment logo. But here's my version of a personal learning environment. And I want to connect to this. Because in my view, and again, remember, we're thinking Web 2.0, a personal learning environment is not just something that you use to access content. It's not just a web top. It's not just a reader like NetCenter or any of these things. So let me select some content. This MyGlue is a little application that takes a bunch of RSS feeds and joins them together. And what this one in particular does is it takes some of my feeds. It takes my website. It takes my Flickr posts. It takes my bookmarks. And so here is the photograph that I just took of all of you earlier today. Now it's showing up as a resource in this distributed network. And now most learning, you just sort of stop here, right? But the idea of a personal learning environment is that now I have something that I can work with, and I can do something like, here is the, I need to learn how to spell better, a group of people in, how's that? Okay. And so, and you can imagine now, this is just a plain, ordinary text editor with some nifty commands, but you can imagine any number of different types of content manipulation things. You can imagine Writely being in there. You can imagine Gliffy being in there. Any of these Web 2.0 applications could go in there instead of that content window. So now I'm working with this resource that I've just created. I'm working with this resource, and this is a learning resource. Why is it a learning resource? Because I'm using it in learning. And so now what am I going to do with this? What is my user ID? I think that's it. And everyone cover your eyes. Like I said, I'm not a good programmer, unlike other people. Never mind. And let's see if that's done its thing yet. Whoops, that's not it. That's not it. Too many things. Okay, content is uploaded. All right, now, where has it been uploaded, you might ask? YUKONMANIA. It's been uploaded to a blog. And well, it should be uploaded to a blog. Yeah, sometimes they don't show up right away, which is unfortunate. They used to show up right away. It worked really well. Isn't that odd, though? Usermania. MANIA. Anyhow, normally it just shows up here. It will show up here in a little bit. And you can see I've given this example before. Maybe I'm not looking at the right blog. Why didn't I do that? Never mind. But the idea here is, you can see the content moving through the system, right? It goes from my camera to my computer to Flickr to an RSS feed to my personal learning environment. Then I mix it up. I repurpose it. I reshape it. Then I feed it forward, and it's going to go out into an RSS feed. It's going to go out into Blogger and then again into an RSS feed. So what we're seeing now is the emergence of, if you will, a personalized web in Web 2.0. Personalized web in the sense that we're moving from being content consumers to being content creators. And in my view, this creates a very different picture of learning. Now, again, we can go back to, I think, actually both Martin's talk and Rob's talk. We look at the response from institutions, and when institutions see things like wikis and blogs and things like that, it's like we heard this morning, first thing they want to do is put these things inside the learning management system, bring them inside the institutional umbrella so that we can standardize them for reasons like providing support, quote-unquote, or, in my view, the more likely reason is to control the environment, to make sure that proper acceptable use policies are being followed, that people aren't breaking copyright and horrible evil things like that. But what's happening, in my view, is that the instinctive institutional response when they see something like Blogger or wikis or whatever is to say, well, can we make that fit into our picture of learning? Can we make them like us? And it really does become a question of control. We've all heard about learner-centered learning over the last 10 whatever years. But there's learner-centered learning where you think about the needs of the student first and then deliver them. And then there's learner-centered learning in the sense that the learner is able to actually take control of their own learning. And again, this morning we heard, oh, well, you know, sometimes we really do know better than the learner. And yeah, it's true. Typically, we're smarter than the learner. But I'm reminded of the distinction that Morton Flake Paulson made in his talk yesterday between collaboration and cooperation, where collaboration is something that you're required to do in a classroom, and cooperation is something that you choose to do voluntarily. So in both cases, they're working together. But in one case, the institution mandates the approach, and in the other case, the student chooses the approach. I found it very interesting that in the statistics that he cited, something like, I forget what it was, 46% or something like that, of people given the choice chose not to cooperate, chose to work on their own. And I was thinking about that because one of the people in the audience said, well, yeah, but, you know, I can recall some cases where a shy person came back after and said, you know, this collaboration really helped me. Being required to collaborate really helped me. And, yeah, I can imagine a case, I can imagine many cases where being required to do something is actually good for you. But I think back to my own experiences in schools, I don't work well with others. And so when I have been required to collaborate with others, I have found it to be actually a poor experience and detracted from my learning. And so I'm thinking about, under what conditions is it reasonable to require that somebody do something? Thinking about that, and it struck me that, you know, there's no such thing as a Hippocratic oath in education, and maybe there should be. Because one of the elements of the Hippocratic Oath is, first and foremost, do no harm. And if you cause harm by requiring something, then you're violating some sort of non-existent educational Hippocratic Oath. So under what condition does it make sense to require that somebody do something? If, and only if, you know that in all cases it will do no harm. So I'm sitting there in the back row, because I always sit in the back row of that talk, and I'm thinking there, you know, how can you be requiring people to collaborate when you can reasonably predict that some harm will be caused. Not to everybody, but to some people. Learning, and especially online learning, is very much about the creation of the self. And so we reach this tension, don't we? And we see this tension playing out in the way institutions are handling these online learning environments. The institution wants to control what people do. They look at MySpace and they go, oh my God. But as Dana Boyd points out, people are creating their own identity online in places like MySpace. And we've seen that from the very beginning of the online world. We've seen this from the days of MUDs and Sherry Turkle describing people creating their own identities. I've seen it myself. That's where my identity came from. I built it in a machine. Oops. And so, you know, we look at these sorts of things and you know, we look at how we're designing learning and how we're designing learning technology, and we're asking ourselves, well, what kind of model are we using? And again, I'm sitting in the back row as Rob Coper is talking, and I'm thinking, behaviorist. Because, and okay, that's not fair. And maybe it represents a prejudice from being on the other side of the water and all of that. But the thing is, there is a model in his thinking, and I am not convinced that it's a correct model, because I am not convinced that the process of learning has to do with roles and plans and building buildings and architects and things like that. I believe that learning is much more like growing a garden, and in this case, a garden of the mind. I think that where this technology is taking us is away from computers. I think that where this technology is taking us is to take the learning into our lives, into the places where we create things. These ballet dancers are in a place called Mississauga, which is right near Toronto, and they have a building there called the Living Arts Center. And what people do is they go to this building and they just do their own thing. They create hand printing glass, or they learn ballet, all kinds of things. And this is where learning happens, and the resources need to travel to where they're doing these things. There's you can see the inside of the Living Arts Center. There's a guy creating pots or glass or something. And the idea here is that the learning is centered around the interests of the learner, that the learning is immersive. The learning becomes a part of doing. Typically, we separate, and this is what happens on the architecture model, we separate learning from living. But with good syndication, the learning becomes part of the living. And so we get things like game-based learning. Everybody talks about, how do you get games into learning? I want to talk about, how do you get learning into games? People are out there playing Doom. I want to feed them learning information so that while they're running around shooting things, they learn about, oh, I don't know, Barcelona or whatever. Okay, maybe not Barcelona. Workflow learning, informal learning. Jay Cross talks about this. He says 80% of all corporate learning is informal, which means it's not planned, it's not structured, it's exactly not what Rob Coper describes. So how do you do workplace learning? You put the learning into the tools, the hardware, the applications, the environment where people are doing their work. So we should be developing learning not as artifacts, but as something that's dynamic, something that's living. And that's what we're seeing at Web 2.0. The first iteration, we're seeing these dynamic content sources, blogging, podcasting. Nobody remembers a blog post from 6 months ago or whatever. It's a very dynamic, changing environment. Think of it, again, as more like an ecosystem than like a building. The second phase of this is the learning network. The learning network is what happens after blogging. It's what happens when we put the learning into this kind of syndicated content environment. And in trying to characterize what this learning network should look like, what the basic design principles should look like, again, I find it handy to compare the traditional model of learning with the new model of networks that's coming up. And I actually drew a diagram not too long ago, and I know you can hardly read this, but in the architecture, in the old way, the group way, the forced collaboration way, unity is a dominant virtue. We're all talking from the same songbook, or singing from the same songbook. I guess you don't talk from songbooks, do you? But in a network, what you value is diversity. You value many different things. In a group environment, coordination is the order of the day. And this, again, is the idea that there will be a leader, a professor, a teacher, something like that. But in a network, autonomy is the day, where each entity in the network decides for themselves what to do. In a group environment, it's a closed environment. There's a fence or a wall separating us from them. Think about how we've designed our schools and our universities, where it's very clearly segregated, and you have classes and groups and all of this separated from everything else that you do. But a network only works if it's open, only if anybody can plug into this, if anybody can put stuff into the network or draw stuff out of the network. The group or the architectural way of thinking of things is that it's distributive. What I mean by that is that knowledge or content or whatever comes from a single source and then is distributed or dispensed out to the masses, a lot like this talk. But in a network, the knowledge is connective. That is to say, knowledge may be created at any point in the network and then is distributed through the network through these connections. And so it gives us a picture on the network side of a model of learning where you don't have this clear separation between teacher and student, where you don't have this clear establishment of learning institutions per se. It gives you a model of learning where to do something is to teach something, where being a physicist is one and the same thing as being a physics teacher, and being a physics student is one and the same as being a physicist. And I wish I could expand on that more, but he's been giving me little cards, and that is all the time that I have. So I hope it wasn't too chaotic to talk. And I thank you for remaining here at the very end of this conference.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Both Stephen and I know that we had very attentive faces from all of you. I saw almost no one, perhaps someone over there, going into an inner exile. You were very much with us in this talk. So thank you. You evoke interest, and we have an audience probably with many questions. Could I start with asking you, how many encountered a new term or concept in this talk? Well, you talk for often years in just few cases. Most of us encounter new terms. So question, Stephen?
It never did upload, I don't know why.
Okay, thank you again for this inspiring talk, and I really learned a new word, which is nifty. but having said that, I beg to differ in one point, and probably because I'm German, the point you emphasize the attractiveness of RSS in comparison to worked out meta data scheme, mm-hmm. And there an analogy comes to my mind, which is the attractiveness and because of the eagerness of HTML in the early days of the web, and was taken by many people and put it into use because it was so easy, and browsers were very forgiving for setting that tag and things. And now, 20 years later, some of the stakeholders are struggling really hard to for much of this really worthy content is in that bad format where you cannot get more information out. So if I hear that something is simple and therefore attractive, I'm probably more skeptical than you about that.
Okay, let me, I want to take this in a different direction. It's not simply that RSS is more simple. Because, yeah, HTML is more simple than SGML. It's a lot easier to use. The browsers are a lot more forgiving. But there is a sense in which you could say that, you know, there is a single best way to create a website. But when we're talking about metadata, when we're talking about metadata encoding formats, what we're talking about has to do not so much with the syntax, not so much with the how to construct a web page, but we're talking about things like semantics. We're talking about meaning. And once you start trying to standardize meaning, then the presumption that there is one best way no longer applies. And indeed, what happens is when you try to standardize meaning, you end up with an imposition of one best way. And again, I don't mean to pick on Rob Koper. I don't know if he's here because I can't see very well, but it's just a handy example. Because he's working on an open source project, and he talked about these associates. It's an interesting designation that work with this. But the thing is, if you want to work with Rob Koper's project, you need to think Rob Koper's way. You need to use words Rob Koper's way. Oh, he's Dutch. I'm not. I have a totally different worldview. So now, either I have to become Dutch, or at least see the world the way he does, or I can't work with him, right? And neither of those alternatives is attractive. Neither of those is sustainable. So we have to have a mechanism of semantics which is not rigid. We have to have a mechanism of semantics which is as simple as possible to allow as many variables as possible.
I'm afraid I've got an epistemological question for you. A lot of people have argued that science is a result of the technology that you mentioned, the printing press, where knowledge is public, could be challenged, and so on. What I see in your vision for learning, which incidentally I share in the future, what's the epistemological impact of that from being on what we perceive of as knowledge, and does that undermine the scientific approach to learning and so on?
Yeah, it does. And there's, the scientific approach, and there's an awful lot packed into that, right? Because it includes not simply scientific methodology, the scientific method, experiments, confirmation, falsification, prediction, projection, all of that sort of stuff. But it also includes the systems and structures that we've set up in order to do science. And even things like universities and institutes and all of that sort of thing. Now, what happens is that it's not simply that just anybody can produce science. That doesn't change, right? I mean, people, you still have to be a skilled nuclear technician in order to work in nuclear reactors, right? We're not going to let six-year-olds run nuclear reactors. Not going to happen. But the voice or the opinion of a six-year-old comes to inform the debate or the discussion or the discovery process of nuclear reactors. And you think, well, how could that possibly happen? Because six-year-olds know nothing about nuclear reactors, which is true. But they know everything about being six-year-old. And although we have no particular knowledge of a connection between being a six-year-old and running a nuclear reactor, there might be one. And we would never be able to detect that connection without the input of the six-year-old. And I'm deliberately choosing a very extreme example, an example we'd think, oh, there's no way, right?
So we now need to have a picture of the science of nuclear reactors that takes into account, and seriously takes into account, the opinions of six-year-olds as part of the overall picture, which means that the method of organizing the running of a nuclear reactor needs to change. It means that the traditional structure, where there is a direction from the top, and this direction is the be-all and the end-all of how this thing is going to work, that needs to be changed in order to account for these other points of view. But more than that, we have this view of science as you go out, you study something, you look at something, you say, oh, yeah, okay, that's true, because I've seen it. But again, when you include the points of view of many people, and not just the empirical scientist, you come to see very quickly that for any given object, there are many different points of view, and there is no one single way to describe something, and that the actual truth, if you will, of the matter is going to be some sort of emergent result from the combination of these many points of view. So when I say the six-year-old informs nuclear science, I mean that in the most serious way, that what they have to say about nuclear reactors actually informs the truth of what nuclear reactors comes to be. And so, you know, the idea of there being an authority on nuclear reactors changes. The idea of there being, you know, the one source, that changes. I'm sort of breaking down here. But you sort of get the picture. That was a bad explanation, wasn't it? But well, it's a hard concept. It is a hard concept. Because no person knows the truth. There is no truth. The only way we get at anything, and this is the case both for observation and for network phenomena, is through a methodology, is through setting up the governance and the organization of knowledge in an appropriate way. And the example of that people have been tossing around is the NASA space shuttles, where truth and knowledge was defined in this traditional hierarchical way, and it turned out to be exactly wrong. And you needed to set up the interchange between scientists and experts and everybody else in such a way that the opinion of somebody who said, gee, you might be able to break things with foam, that opinion was taken seriously. If they had taken that opinion seriously, they wouldn't have had the shuttle accident.
There are very many questions.
Okay, I'm sure I'll be shorter.
So would it be possible to phrase the questions quite short and also take answers? So we start with Helen. And yes.
Thanks for a fantastic keynote. That was very dynamic. I'm glad to share yourself, the whole idea of personal learning environment, and I think you talked about yourself there. One thing that I did notice that was just interesting, I'd like to point it out, was I know you've been on the conversation really very quickly, and you've had some interesting exchanges with James Farmer over blogging, and it looked to me like it was almost paralleling the Blackboard Desire to Learn debate. It was quite interesting. Would you comment on that, please?
I'm trying to remember what the discussion with James Farmer was.
I think you were implying that he's decided that he owns the idea of educational blogging, perhaps.
Oh, I don't remember saying that. But I certainly would say that if I thought that he believed he owned the idea of educational blogging. James Farmer, for those of you who don't know, runs a service in Australia called edublogs.org? I believe it's .org. And he's been providing free blogs to people who are involved in education, and I certainly support this idea. The only thing I would say is you don't have to go to James Farmer, but I'm sure he would say that too, so I'm not really sure where we'd find a dispute, except now he's working for a major newspaper, and I'd be critical of that, but that's a whole different story. So I'm sorry, I just don't remember.
A set of three guys, you and both. And
ignore me. Okay. Hello, I'm Thomas from Nepal University of Scotland. Question. Would I right to conclude that what you said with us just now is your vision, or like the vision of many of us, for learning,
yes,
but not for education? And if this vision can be shared with countries like the United Kingdom and the rest of the European Union, we will still have terms like teaching learning and assessment groups and teaching learning and assessment strategies.
Now, Rob Cooper, handy target, said, I use the term competencies instead of learning because the funders don't like learning. They like competencies. And I'm sitting there, way in the back, row sitting there thinking, so our theory, our terminology now is going to be determined by the funders. And I'm wondering, under what principle of epistemology is it that having money makes somebody smart? Especially government money. I think, it's certainly my theory of learning. I have minimal faith in the capacity of educational institutions to give up power. And because they are unlikely to give up power, they are unlikely to make the changes that will be required to support student empowerment. But students will be empowered one way or another because they have the tools and they have the capacities now. And so consequently, I think your characterization is right. I'm talking about a theory of learning, and this will happen mostly outside educational institutions. And education will gradually, unless institutions change in ways I don't expect, will gradually become, I don't know, like horseshoe making or something like that. So something quaint that some people do. If you're rich enough, maybe you can go to a resort or something and do education. But most people will do learning.
So it's time for a last question. You can pick it. I have exactly the same answer.
Okay. So
what are the odds?
It's then.
It's got to be probability.
I think we are running. We are enjoying ourselves. It's great. But I think we are running out of time.
Hi. Thanks for really interesting talk to you. I just wanted to pick up on what I thought would be the significant shift for community network.
Yeah.
And I was interested as well in this kind of anti. Collaboration, possibly anti-cooperation as well. And one of the features, I think, of groups and communities is trust, and that's what builds with communities and collaborative cooperation. And I was wondering what you thought about building trust in networks.
Yeah, there's trust and there's trust. And there's groups and there's groups, too. I mean, and I want to avoid being characterized as being totally in favor of networks, totally opposed to groups. Right? In some cases, groups are good. If you're creating a hockey team or in Europe a football team, you want a group because you want that cohesiveness, you want that bonding, you want everybody working toward the same end. You want an emotional attachment to what you're doing. But if you do that in learning, I think that's a very dangerous thing because You're creating this emotional attachment. You're creating this uncritical, unthinking adherence to both your group of peers and even more dangerously, your teachers. So, and you know, trust. There's trust and there's trust. Trust, when they talk about trust in a network environment, what they mean is, I've set up the situation in such a way that nobody can do anything to me. That's trust. Alright, and that, well, what do you think trusted computing is, right? Trusted computing, in quotation marks. Trusted computing, properly so called, is a type of computing environment such that on your computer, there is an allocation of memory, of disk space, that you cannot change. That way, Microsoft or the content provider can trust that area because they set it up that nothing can change it, not even you, the owner of the computer. But now, would you trust your computer if your computer had trusted computing? Well, probably not, right? There is a danger in putting yourself in a position where you are unable to rationally and cognitively respond to people or organizations or companies that are in positions of power. And so my estimation is that, you know, if I had to characterize trust, for me, trust only exists if I have the capacity for autonomous behavior, if I have the capacity to make my own decisions in a rational and clear-headed way. That is not the best answer, but that's the answer I have right now.
Thank you very, very much for all the questions. I'm sorry we couldn't room everyone. We are already several minutes behind the schedule. So thank you very much for them. And also thank you very much, Stephen, for an inspiring firework ending this interesting conference. So thank you very much.
Thank you.